Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
Overall, for the all-item CPI, prices stayed flat in October of 2023.
Megan Schweitzer's a USDA economist looking at the Consumer Price Index.
So the overall rate of inflation was unchanged from September to October, and prices for all items were 3.2% higher than in October of last year.
Schweitzer also reviewing what the latest Consumer Price Index says about last month's food price situation.
The food prices increased by 0.3% in October and were 3.3% higher than this time last year. And food at home prices, the grocery prices, also rose by 0.3% in October. And food at home prices were 2.1% higher than this time last year.
This is Agriculture Today.
We, the largest developing country, that is China, and the largest developed country, the United States, we must get along with each other.
Speaking recently in San Francisco, Chinese President Xi Jinping.
China is ready to be a partner and friend of the United States. The fundamental principles that we follow in handling China-U.S. relations are mutual respect, peaceful coexistence, and win-win cooperation. China never bets against the United States and never interferes in its internal affairs. China has no intention to challenge the United States or to unseat it. Instead, we will be glad to see a confident, open, ever-growing, and prosperous United States. Likewise, the United States should not bet against China or interfere in China's internal affairs. Whatever stage of development it may reach, China will never pursue hegemony or expansion and will never impose its will on others. China does not seek spheres of influence and will not fight a cold war or a hot war with anyone.
But a common theme recently has been concern over Chinese purchases of U.S. farmland. Roger McCohen is a Washburn University tax law specialist.
This has been a big issue in legislatures across the country this year. Numerous states have enacted more restrictions with respect to foreign ownership, and many of those are tying the restrictions to countries or persons that are agents of countries that are on the foreign adversaries list, and that's a list that the federal government produces. And so we have countries on there such as North Korea and China and Russia and Venezuela and a couple of others that are on that list. There's usually about six or seven of those countries that are there. And the concerns have been highlighted by some pretty high-profile incidents that we've had over the past year. Of course, there's been an attempt by the Chinese to buy farmland very close to a military base in North Dakota, seeing China acquire a large amount of farmland in Florida as well as Texas. And, of course, the couple of months ago, the Chinese balloon, that spy balloon that flew all across the United States during these legislative sessions, highlighting the tensions, too. So what we have seen are that Arkansas and Virginia have enacted laws with tighter restrictions on foreign investment in land in those states. Utah and Idaho also did that in the 2023 legislative session. North Dakota has two bills. They did enact a law that amends the existing foreign ownership law in North Dakota to restrict foreign governments from acquiring or holding an interest in North Dakota agricultural land. There's been another proposal in North Dakota that does something a little bit different. There's also a proposal currently on the table in Montana, Oklahoma, and Tennessee. And Oklahoma and Tennessee, those bills have been passed by the legislature, but they're not yet fully enacted. And so we may see some more developments here in the next few days, because these bills that have passed are now at the governor's desk in these states, and they're ripe for signature. And here we are in May, approaching the middle part of May. This is about the time when the sessions end, the bills that have been passed either are or are not signed by the state governor. And in Kansas also considered, it started considering two bills. It got boiled down into one, but it did not pass this session.
And this is Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
I think we can all agree farmers, ranchers, and foresters are the original conservationists, and no one cares more for the environment than those with livelihoods that depend on it.
Representative G.T. Thompson is chairman of the House Ag Committee. Earlier this year at an EPA oversight hearing.
In the first hearing I hosted as the chairman of the House Committee on Agriculture, members heard from a variety of challenges American farmers and ranchers are currently facing. A recurring theme throughout the hearing was uncertainty, mostly stemming from nonsensical regulations and policies perpetuated by the Biden administration. From my vantage point, it appears EPA and USDA are not only playing in one another's sandbox, but are perpetuating wrong-headed priorities. EPA wants to dictate what producers grow and how to grow it, and USDA is laser-focused on expanding funding and policies related to climate. Historically, EPA has overregulated the agriculture industry, and this continues today, whether it be the war against crop protection tools, regulatory whiplash about what defines the waters of the United States, or WOTUS, or a top-down prescription of electric vehicles. You know, American farmers and ranchers need access to crop protection tools to control damaging pests and weeds, increase yields with fewer inputs, and implement voluntary incentive-based conservation practices such as reduced and no-till. Until recently, producers relied on the science-driven, risk-based registration and registration review process established under the Federal Insecticide, Fungicide, and Rodenticide Act, affectionately known as FIFRA. To provide certainty surrounding the use of these tools. In the past 2 years, the agency has sought to restrict or cancel several important chemistries, including chlorpyrifos, atrazine, rodenticides, Oregon phosphates, and many more. Additionally, it is concerning to hear USDA's expertise and advice was ignored in many of these decisions. These actions erode public trust in the regulatory process, undermine confidence and scientific integrity of the EPA, and cause extreme uncertainty for producers who seek to provide the world with the safest, most abundant, and most affordable food and fiber supply in the world. Simply put, any decisions related to crop protection tools should be based on actual science, not political science. Additionally, and something of a bipartisan interest, is uncertainty created by the Biden administration's effort to redefine WOTUS. This is the third time in 7 years the agency has attempted to rewrite this definition under the Clean Water Act, and comes only 2 years after the Navigable Waters Protection Rule finally provided long-awaited certainty for farmers, ranchers, and landowners. And while producers wait for the Supreme Court's decision on a case related to WOTUS regulations, the Biden administration's definition is far from being durable, as claimed by the EPA. In fact, the rule has already been blocked from gaining into effect across 26 states. Further, both the House and the Senate recently passed a bipartisan resolution of disapproval, and I was proud to co-sponsor that resolution. I'd like to thank Ranking Member Scott for joining us in the effort to provide certainty for those who need it most. Now, I'm disappointed President Biden once again turned his back on rural America and vetoed this resolution. In your confirmation hearing, you, Administrator Reagan, promised to have an open-door policy for farmers, and this commitment to listen, combined with your understanding of agriculture, seemed very promising to many. However, the regulatory agenda being pursued by this administration constantly misses the mark and exposes rural America to further ambiguity and wrong-headed policies. In 1956, President Eisenhower said, quote, "Farming looks mighty easy when your plow is a pencil and you're 1,000 miles away from the cornfield," end quote. Well, this rings true today, and I implore the agency to spend more time in the field and less time proposing disastrous, untested rulemakings.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
Make it flexible. I've seen some of these that it's so unwieldy that it would be very difficult to follow it.
Paul Niefer is a financial planner in Washington State. Talks about buy-sell agreements.
Update the valuations or review the formulas. Does that valuation, is it still accurate? If you have a formula, does it still make sense? Now, does it need to be every year? Maybe not, but certainly families, at the minimum, probably every other year, really need to review that. Make sure you get them signed. I don't know how many buy-sell agreements I see floating around. Yeah, we have a buy-sell agreement. Can never find one. There's not one in the attorney's office. You know, they don't have the record. It was just there, but it was never signed, or not all the parties signed it. Those don't work if they're not all signed. Also, don't use a formula that makes no sense. That creates too much liability or disharmony among the kids or the heirs. And don't overburden its buyers. You know, we know that farming is a very capital-intensive type business. If you're having an agreement that says you're going to have to pay full fair market value, all cash, probably not going to happen. But if you put in there, okay, it's a payment, very little money down over a 10-year period, low interest rate, that works very well. But that really needs to be part of the buy-sell agreement. It needs to be signed. Everybody needs to understand that's what's going to happen. Also remember, even though you have a buy-sell agreement, the parties can always agree, hey, we're not going to follow the agreement. We want to do it this way, and that's fine. I've seen that multiple times. Buy-sell agreement might say, hey, somebody is selling their assets and they're going to have to take a 35% discount. I've actually seen siblings say, that's not fair to the siblings. We're going to pay them for full fair market value. Really, that buy-sell agreement is there if you don't get along. It's sort of the weapon that you employ. Hey, parties aren't getting along. Here's what we have to do.
What about handling land assets?
Definitely place it into limited liability entity. That's almost a slam dunk. You may want to consider voting and non-voting units. I had a call with one of my ranch clients a couple of days ago on this particular subject. As far as how does this voting and non-voting work? I'm transferring a lot of value, but I want to make sure that I'm still protected. Well, voting means that you're in control, and the non-voting gets the value. So that's something we definitely do on the land asset side. Again, can't stress it enough. Make sure there's a buy-sell in place, that everybody understands the buy-sell. And we like to transfer some during life. Not a lot, but we do like to transfer some. We like the next generation to have some buy-in, have them put some cash in, or maybe loan it to them and then have it paid back to you out of distributions from the partnership or from the entity. Remember, equal is not necessarily fair in farming. If you have on-farm heirs, they've been working on that farm for 20 years and they haven't been building up equity outside of the farm or on their own, maybe part of that process upon your death or your estate plan is the on-farmers are going to get more, because that's sort of compensating them for getting less value during their lifetime. Everybody's different. There is no one, it's like a puzzle. We got all these puzzle pieces, and we know what the end result needs to be, but we have to put that puzzle together, and what puzzle pieces work for one farm operation is not necessarily going to work for another farm operation.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
I agree with you that it's essential that we put the federal budget on a path that's sustainable.
That's Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. Could be talking today, but it was actually 3 years ago.
We're responsible and make sure that what we do with respect to deficits and debt leave future generations better off. But the most important thing, in my view, that we can do today to put us on a path of fiscal sustainability is to defeat the pandemic, to provide relief to American people, and then to make long-term investments that will help the economy grow and benefit future generations. To avoid doing what we need to do now to address the pandemic and the economic damage that it's causing would likely leave us in a worse place fiscally and with respect to our debt situation than taking the steps that are necessary in doing that through deficit finance. We really have to worry about scarring due to this pandemic, of workers and the loss of small businesses that can really harm the long-run potential productivity of our economy and leave us with long-run problems that would make it difficult to get back on the growth path that we were on. And it's really critically important to provide this relief now, and I believe it would be a false economy to stint. But over the longer term, I would agree with you that the long-term fiscal trajectory is a cause for concern. It's something we will eventually need to attend to, but it's also important for America to invest and invest in our infrastructure, invest in our workers, invest in R&D, the things that make our economy grow faster and make it more competitive. And it's important to remember that we're in a very low interest rate environment. And that's something that existed before the pandemic hit. Interest rates were low even before the financial crisis of 2008. This has been a trend in developed economies. You can see it across the developed world, and it represents structural shifts that are likely to be with us a long time. So although the debt-to-GDP ratio has increased, it's important to note that the interest burden of the debt, interest as a share of GDP, is no higher now than it was before the financial crisis in 2008, in spite of the fact that our debt has escalated. And of course, interest rates can increase. Eventually, we have to make sure that primary deficits in the budget are sufficiently small, that we're on a sustainable path, but right now our challenge is to get America back to work and to defeat the pandemic.
Congress and the administration still trying to figure out how to get on track. It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
From my perch as chairman of the House Science Committee, I have seen issues arise when the agency scientists at USDA and EPA are at odds.
Former chairman of the House Ag Committee, Frank Lucas from Oklahoma, talking to the administrator of EPA, Michael Regan.
Primary example of EPA's action regarding chloroPFAS uses. When USDA's Office of Pest Management Policy provided your agency with evidence that certain uses could be retained to meet safety standards, but EPA chose to ignore that evidence. So I guess my first question is, in your written testimony, you spoke about your strong desire to work closely with the farming and ranching community to identify practical science-based policies that protect the environment and ensure a vibrant and productive agricultural system. Can you explain, then, why the scientific expertise at USDA has been sidelined on this issue and on various others, such as the atrazine mitigation measures? Now, just to name a few, Director.
Well, I'll start with the chlorpyrifos, because that's one that our agencies have talked quite a bit about. And I think what the constraint was is the court weighed in and said that they were fed up and frustrated with EPA's inaction. So they set a high bar and a timeline that was really hard to meet. And so I would argue that the difference between USDA and EPA on this instance isn't the science. It's how we had to apply to what the court required for us to do. And they set a bar that was too high for us to meet in the time that they gave us using the science that we had. And so we made the best decision that we could make with the science that we have to comply with the mandate from the court, which that mandate from this court was much different for chlorpyrifos than it has been for any other pesticide we've seen.
Because of your stated commitment to science-based decision-making in carrying out the mission of the EPA to protect human health and environment, do you believe, in a general sense, I guess I'm asking, that science and technology play a critical role at EPA and should be utilized by other federal agencies?
I do. I do believe science and technology play critical roles.
Do you think that every EPA administrator now and in the future should place a high importance on science and technology activities of the agency?
Absolutely, and I believe if that had been done in the past, we wouldn't have 50 years of ignoring the ESA, and this administration would find itself in the position that it is in.
Do you think that in your position, the administrator more frequently coming before secondary committees like you're doing today for ag would help better coordinate activities and shed light on the cross aspects of EPA's work?
You know, any way we can be transparent, any way we can exchange information, I'll raise my hand for that.
Well, having the privilege of being both a member of the awesome Agriculture Committee and the Science and Space and Technology Committee, where we're very focused on research and science in the future, I look forward to seeing you in front of the Science Committee. Matter of fact, we'll get you an invitation fairly soon. And together we'll work on these issues and try to make sure that science is the predominant force when we make decisions. I respect the courts. I respect differences of opinion. But when the science is generated by people closer to the issue in the field and the use, I think we have to give them the benefit of the doubt.
A discussion from an EPA oversight hearing earlier this year. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
We typically like to see the assets transferred to retirement, you know, the equipment. Got to be careful. If you sell an installment sale, that triggers tax, so maybe you incorporate with the lease of the land. You know, there's ways of maybe not necessarily eliminating the tax, but deferring it over a 5 or 10 year period.
When you look at financial planning and estate planning, Paul Niefer, a financial planner from Washington State.
Now, if you have too negative capital, you know, that might take 5 or 10 years to get rid of that. And we also see a lot of times the use of a part gift or part sale. What I typically see with mom and dad when they're transferring assets to the next generation, yes, they want to make sure they get sufficient income for their retirement from those assets or value, but they also don't want to overburden the next generation. They want to make sure that, that, you know, 5 years doesn't go by and suddenly the son or the daughter's coming, mom and dad, we can't pay you anymore. This is just too much. And as I said earlier, we don't really like corporations. Well, this is a case where an S corporation might make a lot of sense, or a C corp. And what do I mean by that? By placing equipment and, let's say, unsold grain and cost of growing crop and prepaid farm expenses, by putting that into a corporation, we now convert that all from being ordinary income to being capital gains for the generation that's selling, and that can reduce their burden. That allows them to discount it. They can discount it to the next generation because the next generation is saying, well, we don't really like that as well, because we don't get a step up in basis. We don't get to redepreciate the equipment and so on. So that's why there's a discount. It's sort of a win-win for both parties. We see that happen once in a while. Don't forget, you start transferring the farm assets and you can mess up FSA payments. Just think CFAP. You know, you might have had 5 or 6 owners and suddenly you put in an LLC, and under the old rules, you would qualify if you're a partnership. You might have qualified for, let's say, $1.5 million, $2 million. Under the rules with you being an LLC, let's say, you might only qualify for $250. Could be $750, but it might only be $250. So we really need to understand the interplay of income taxes, estate taxes, and then FSA. And it's a symbiotic relationship, all three of those.
There are some who think financial planning, estate planning is just a will. But Niefer says, don't wait.
Again, don't make the cost too high to the next generation. That's really something I want to stress. I've seen too many struggles in this area, and most of the older generation understands this because they know how capital intensive this is. And again, don't do it too quick. Make sure you plan for it. Too many times I've had farmers call me up and say, hey, Paul, this is my last year of farming, and I want to transfer to the next generation, and I want to pay as least amount of taxes as I can. It's a little tougher, you know, so we tend to want to have probably a 5-year window, 3 to 5 year, minimum of 3 years, 5-year window. That allows us to do the best planning.
What's even worse? Waiting till death.
Don't wait till death. This is where we start wanting to transferring some of those land assets during lifetime. Like I say, you get the next generation involved. They understand how this is going to work. They are part of the LLC annual meeting to go through what's happened, what's our rent, how are we setting the rent, what crop should we be planting, and so on. That gets some ownership from that next generation, especially maybe the off-farm heirs that understand, hey, farming is a low-return business, but we want to keep it in the family.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
The government is out this week with its Consumer Price Index report tracking inflation during October.
Overall, this was a good report for consumers.
Agriculture Department economist Megan Schweitzer says for all goods and services, zero inflation last month. But she says prices for food did inch up a bit, but only by 0.3% and up by just 2.1% from where they were in October a year ago. So food price inflation is cooling down. Schweitzer says prices for several major food groups are currently selling for less than October a year ago. Products including
eggs.
Down 22%.
Fresh vegetables.
Down about 2%.
Fish and seafood.
Down about 1%.
And dairy products.
Those costing about 0.5% less than this time last year. So we did not see big price hikes for most food categories.
But what we did see was stronger price growth for meats this month.
Especially beef, those prices have gone up every month of this year and are now about 9% higher than this time a year ago. Gary Crawford, Washington.